Evening, brothers and sisters. Samson, a man of faith. And this is the first this evening of three talks. There's so much material with Samson. I could actually do with a couple more, to be frank with you. But here we are. We can talk on these three subjects regarding Samson. That dealing with his birth tonight. And then secondly, the dealings with Delilah. And then thirdly, the end of his life, which is such a wonderful exhortation for us. So they're the three things we're going to be looking at, God willing, over the next 3 weeks. But before we get going, we're looking at Judges 13, some important background. So 10-15 minutes, just going through some of the background to the situation. End of the time of Joshua, you've got the situation there with the tribes. And I'll get this red light to work. This is what we're really interested in, because this is the tribe from which Samson springs. And notice how close this is to the Philistines' territory. In fact, he's very much on the borders, and it's the Philistines are the big problem in the day in the life of Samson. So you can see why I've highlighted that. Before we just move away from it, it's worth remembering that when you've got those different tribes, you get a leader of each of those tribes who effectively becomes a judge for each of those tribes. Some come to the fore and are very prominent. Others are lost in scripture, probably because they're not worthy of being noted. The book of Judges, we've got 12 judges in that book, the last of which at the bottom of the page is Samson. It's Paul through the Spirit tells us that the time of the judges spans 450 years. And those 12 don't span all those, because we've actually got Eli and Samuel in the book of Samuel and so on. So the judges actually go on further than the book of Judges. Now Samson's the last one, as we have it in the book of Judges. And he's there in chapters 13 to 16. And then the last five chapters of Judges, a bit of an appendix really, telling us something of the background and how awful it was that these judges had to live in and contend with. And those last chapters, or at the end of Judges, chronologically speaking, are actually at the very beginning of the times of the judges. And that's important when we consider Samson in a few minutes. Just to highlight the fact that, you know, we have different characters in different parts. You know, these are the judges, different areas. So Jephthah way over here, you know, completely different terrain to Samson. Sometimes more than one tribe is unified, that's true. Think of that particularly with Deborah and Barak. A group of tribes came together. Tribes that didn't help them in the warfare are a rebuke for that. But so often it's only a part of Israel involved. I don't want you to take this diagram too seriously, because I think the dating is definitely up for debate, and I'm not clever enough to know exactly who's going to be right when it comes to this dating. But I'll put it up there because you'll notice here you've got Eli, who I've mentioned already, and Samuel. But running on the same time, we've got Samson here. See that in the green? You've also got these judges too. So don't fall into the trap of thinking that the judges, you know, go nice and separate and distinct in terms of time. They overlap in terms of time. And Samson overlaps very much with Samuel. I actually think that green box should be a little bit further to the right, but there, that's a little point. I'm just making the point now. Samson and Samuel were probably born at the same time, you know, give it a handful of years, one way or the other. Samson comes to the foreground as an adult and as a warrior before Samuel does, but they're hard on each other's heels, really. Now, in the book of Judges, book of Joshua, we have the lots given for the inheritance of the land. And as I say, Samson comes from the tribe of Dan. And I'm just listing out here now the seventh lot, which fell to them. Numerically, they were the second biggest tribe, but they didn't get the second biggest in terms of territory, actually. But for all their numerical strength, they weren't very good at subduing the Canaanites. And I just want to highlight in red those three places, because they come to the fore in the story of Samson. But there you have it. That's the lot that was given to those of Dan. And I'll now take you to Judges chapter 18. And as I say, Judges 18 is early on in the times of the Judges. So although there's a couple of chapters on from the record of Samuel, this is before Samson, this is before Samson, sometime before Samson. And I'm just taking you to chapter 18, and we're in these chapters that are altogether ugly, I have to say. Not good times at all. And we find that the Danites, unable to take the territory allotted to them, decide to go elsewhere. And we read in verse 11, there went out from thence of the family of the Danites, out of Zorah and out of Eshtol. We've just seen those two names mentioned there on that seventh lot. So they had possession of those. But they went out from there, 600 men, appointed with weapons of war. And they went up and pitched into Kirjath-Jearim in Judah, wherefore they called that place Mahaneh-Dan unto this day. Behold, it's behind Kirjath-Jearim. And they passed thence unto Mount Ephraim and came unto the house of Micah. Now they are looking for new territory. They're looking for somewhere else to go that might be easier to take possession of. And these Danites move out of their allotted area and go to the far north. And we find they settle in the north. The people there are not ready and prepared for war, so they're easy relatively to deal with. So they deal with them. But en route, we've got this situation in verse 13 where they encamp near Kirjath-Jearim. And this is fascinating because at Kirjath-Jearim at this time, I'm going to be careful, maybe not exactly actually as is this written, but certainly close to this time period, if not at this time, at Kirjath-Jearim is the ark. The Philistines give up the ark and it comes to Kirjath-Jearim. Notice in the AV, verse 12, it talks about behind Kirjath-Jearim. When it talks about behind, it means west of. So it's close to Kirjath-Jearim and it's just to the west of it. Right, well, what sort of people are these like? Just to take a bit further down the chapter, verse 27. And they took the things which Micah had made and the priests which he had made and came unto Laish and unto a people who were as quiet and secure. And they smote them with the edge of the sword, burnt the city with fire. And there was no deliverer because it was far from Zion and they had no business with any man. And it was in the valley that lieth by Beth Rehob. And they built a city and dwelt therein. And they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born unto Israel. Howbeit the name of the city was Laish at the first. Now mark verse 30. And the children of Dan set up the graven image. And Jonathan the son of Gershon, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. And what we've got there in verse 30 is the grandson of Moses, no less. The grandson of Moses involved with these Danites in setting up a false system of worship. And what we're being told here, that continues right through until the day of the captivity of the land. So this is an awful thing that runs on for many a long year. So these Danites that we read earlier on in the chapter, they leave their allotted area, they give up on it, even though they're close to where the Ark of God will be, or may even be there, and you think they'll be spiritually the better for it. No, they move on, and they find these people here that are at peace, and they take their land, and so in the far north of Israel, Dan's established there, where God did not intend them to be, and they set up a false worship. So let's just now think about the Philistines for a minute. Five cities of the Philistines, five prominent cities: Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, Gath, those five. And they are judged by the Lord. And first judgment that comes upon them is to do with the ark. Because the ark is taken in the days of Eli. And as I say, some of you might be born by this time. The ark is taken, and they bring it out from Shiloh, go to Ebenezer, and between Ebenezer and Aphek is the battle. And at that point, hence that sort of funny yellow triangle, at that point, the ark, with their victory, falls into the hands of the Philistines. And they take it to Ashdod, and they're plagued. Being friendly one to another, but being friendly to one another, they send it to the other Philistines, who are then plagued. And this lovely fraternity goes on. They then pass it on to Ekron, these other Philistines, and they're plagued. And then eventually they give up on it altogether. It falls in the hands of Beth Shemesh, the Israelites, the people of God. And then, as I've said, you're just Jerusalem. So, when the Philistines had the ark, three out of the five cities were punished by God. There they are: Ashdod, Gath, and Ekron. Samson wages war with the Philistines, but he never, ever goes to Ashdod, Gath, or Ekron. You know where he goes. He deals with the other two places. He deals with the other two cities. So this is all part of the background to the life of this man. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, we read, "The men of Kirjath-Jearim came and fetched up the ark of the Lord, brought it into the house of Abinadab in the hill, sanctified Eleazar his son to keep the ark of the Lord. And it came to pass, while the ark abode at Kirjath-Jearim, that the time was long, for it was 20 years. And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord." Now this verse causes problems, because we know that the ark was at Kirjath-Jearim for a lot longer than 20 years, more like 100 years. It was there all the days of Saul, and he reigned 40. So we know it was there for longer than that, but I think this 20 years has reference to the 20 years that we get in the life and experience of Samuel, of Samson. So I'll make reference to that, if not today, next week. So that 20 years is a bit of a flag up to the work of Samson. But if we were to go a little bit further down in that same chapter, we read, after Samuel has waged war against the Philistines and been victorious, we read, "So the Philistines were subdued, and they came no more into the coast of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel." And so what we find is, Samson takes on the Philistines and is victorious for 20 years. And then Samuel takes up the baton, as it were. He takes up the warfare, and he actually crushes them so much that in verse 13 of 1 Samuel 7, that period of oppression is over. Now, it doesn't last for long, because we know that in the reign of Saul, the Philistines come back because of his wickedness. And we know they're there in the days of David. In fact, they go right through to the days of Hezekiah. But in the 40 years of oppression that we'll read in a moment in Judges chapter 13, it's the likes of Samson and Samuel that are dealing with that oppression and dealing with the Philistines. So that's a bit of the background. Just have a look at verse 1. We are going to read this right through, but it's verse 1 at the moment of Judges 13. And it simply says, "And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. There it is. Now the sad thing about this is there's no cry for help. In all the other cases prior to this, there's a period of wickedness, period of judgment, by the Lord sending a nation against them, whether Moabites, whoever they might be. And then there comes a time when the Israelites come to their senses and they cry unto God for help. They cry for deliverance. But you'll notice in the experience of Samson, that does not happen. They're under the power and the influence of the Philistines. And they suffer it, but they never cry unto God. And so verse 1, I'll just point that out very quickly. And if we go to chapter 15... Sadly, these are chapter 14 and 15. We're not going to look at over the next couple of weeks. So I'm going to just take you here very quickly, verse 10 of chapter 15. Samson's been waging war with the Philistines, and he's always on his own. That's another point. There's never any around him. It's not in the days of Barak and there's, you know, thousands behind him. No, he's very much a one-man band. He's on his own. And what do we find? The Philistines come up. They're aggrieved at his action. And in verse 10, the men of Judah said, "Why have he come up against us?" And they answered, "To bind Samson have we come up, to do to him as he hath done to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock at Etam and said to Samson, "Knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is that that thou hast done unto us?" And he said unto them, "As they did unto me, so I have done unto them." And they said unto him, "We are come down to bind thee, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the Philistines." And Samson said unto them, "Swear unto me that ye will not fall unto me yourselves." And with that agreement, Samson comes amongst the Philistines, and he does what he does. But those 3,000, instead of rallying behind the man of faith, instead of getting behind him, they want to take him away and give him to the enemy. They are so much in submission. They're afflicted from to time with these people, but there's no resistance. There's no resistance. So when one comes forth and offers them resistance, that's their attitude. And so I'm going to show you this diagram, which there are many versions of on the internet. You go on the internet, and you'll find this cycle drawn in various ways. I'll just pick this one. That's a typical cycle of events in the book of Judges. Israelites, they sin, there's punishment, they then repent, there's deliverance. No cycle with Samson. It's just not there. It's that bad. It's awful. He's the last judge in the book of the Judges, and it's the nation at the lowest ebb. They're that bad. They don't cry out unto God. They just put up with everything. And it's Samson, on behalf of a remnant, because there's always a remnant, that wages war. So this is some of the background to the times. Just another little thing I want to show you very quickly. Othniel, Ehud, Deborah and Barak, Gideon, just to give you those examples, they always achieve rest. You know, they complete the cycle and there's rest. Samson doesn't achieve it. It has to go through to the days of Samuel. And even then it's only short-lived. That's how bad it is. But by the grace of God, even though they didn't cry for deliverance, God sent them a deliverer. An opportunity was granted unto them to have rest. So, this talk, the angel of the Lord appeared. I'm going to ask Martin now to read Judges 13, please.
Judges chapter 13. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bare not. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said unto her, Behold now, thou art barren and bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come on his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, A man of God came unto me, and his countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God, very terrible. But I asked him not whence he was, nor told me his name. But he said unto me, Behold, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and now drink no wine nor strong drink, neither eat any unclean thing, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, to the day of his death. Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, O my Lord, let the man of God which thou didst send come again unto us, and teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born. And God hearkened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again unto the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. And the woman made haste and ran, and showed her husband, and said unto him, Behold, the man hath appeared unto me that came to me the other day. And Manoah arose and went after his wife, and came to the man, and said unto him, Art thou the man that speakest unto the woman? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, Now let thy words come to pass. How shall we order the child, and how shall we do unto him? And the angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, Of all that I said unto the woman, let her beware. She may not eat of anything that cometh of the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink, nor let any unclean thing. All I commanded her, let her observe. And Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, I pray thee, let us detain thee until we have made ready a kid for thee. And the angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, Though thou detain me, I will not eat of thy bread. If thou wilt offer a burnt offering, thou must offer it unto the Lord. For Manoah knew not that he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, What is thy name, that when thy sayings come to pass, we may do thee honour? And the angel of the Lord said unto him, Why askest thou thus after my name, seeing it is a secret? So Manoah took a kid with a meat offering and offered it upon a rock unto the Lord. And the angel did wondrously, and Manoah and his wife looked on. For it came to pass, when the flame went up toward heaven from off the altar, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. Manoah and his wife looked on it, and fell on their faces to the ground. But the angel of the Lord did no more appear to Manoah and his wife. Then Manoah knew it was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said unto his wife, We shall surely die, because we have seen God. But his wife said unto him, If the Lord were pleased to kill us, he would not have received a burnt offering and a meat offering at our hands. Neither would he have showed us all these things, nor would we at this time have told us such things as these. And the woman bare a son, and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan, between Zorah and Ashtaroth.
Thank you, Martin. So we read of this childless couple, and God intervenes graciously. I suspect they prayed for a child, rather like Zachariah and Elizabeth would do later on. Maybe they prayed for many a year and they came to a point where they prayed no longer. But they also prayed, I'm sure, because they're a faithful couple, for deliverance from the Philistines, for a different order of things. And we read of them in this valley of Sorek. And we notice that Manoah did not live in the camp of Dan. Now, the camp of Dan in the Hebrew is that name I've got there in brackets. I'm not too sure I pronounce it right. I'll probably say it different every time I say it. Mahanedon, Mahanedan. It means camp of Dan, but it seems that the Danites, when they went to Kirjath-Jearim, to the west of it, that was the name of it, Mahanedan. He doesn't go there. He doesn't go there, and he certainly doesn't travel north, to the north of Israel, where the Phoenicians were, which the 600 warriors and their entourage conquered. Not a part of them. This man is a faithful man, and he stays in the allotted area. He stays where his God, the true and living God, wanted all the Danites to be. Now, Dan obviously means judgment or choice, and we're going to see Samson very much perpetrating judgment, but we see here Manoah, faithful man, making a choice. He could have gone with the most. He could have gone with the many. He could have gone with the majority. But he held firm, even though there were Philistines all around. And it wasn't easy. He stayed there. So he is a faithful character as Manoah. And obviously his wife comes out supremely in this chapter. Manoah means a settled spot, or he has come to rest. We've got the name Noah in it. I'm sure we all know Noah means rest. And here's a man who's saying, I'm going to live by my name. I'm resting here. I'm going to put my trust in God, and I'm staying here. I will rest in him. And Zorah is where we find him, which interestingly means hornet sting. And from there, he had a son who delivered a hornet sting to the Philistines. So it's lovely how those names are so appropriate, really, to the situation. And you can see, let's go back again. There here, Kirjath-Jearim's up here, not far away at all. And you know, they're not out of reach of it by any stretch of the imagination. It's within comfortable walking distance. They're close unto that. Kirjath-Jearim and the Ark, they've been fully aware of it. But they've got this problem with these people down here, haven't they? They've got these problems with these warring Philistines. And we read of the angel's words, and he speaks of them. Speaks of her being barren, but she is to conceive. And then he talks to her in terms of the Nazarite vow. Now, it isn't a Nazarite vow in its entirety. You look at number 6, there are differences between number 6 and what we're reading here. But certainly key elements of the Nazarite vow comes out. So this, the idea of not taking of the wine, not taking of the grape and so on, comes out and is put to her. She has an additional point made to her: eat not any unclean thing. As far as I can see, that's not in number 6. You know, you might think it obvious, but in these dark days, not so obvious. You know, you got to think how wayward the Danites were, the people of Israel generally were. So the Lord reiterates that point as well. So in her pregnancy, she used to be very careful. You know, for us now in enlightened, civilized days, we know about what women should be imbibing in during the pregnancy, and supposed to be alcohol-free, aren't they? Here we have it. You know, at the common sense level, at the natural level, it's right. And then talks then of the child that she would conceive. No razor shall come upon his head. So there's no mention here of him not drinking. There's no mention of him not touching the unclean thing. So the three aspects that come out very much with a Nazarite vow, if you read number 6, is not taking of the vow, not touching any dead bodies, and the hair's got to grow. You've got those three elements. Well, those three don't fall to either one of them, but together they do. It's intriguing. And it's interesting, the angel says to her, he shall begin to deliver Israel. He won't finish it, as I was outlining earlier. He will begin the work. He won't be able to finish it. It'd be Samuel who finishes it. Now, she relates those words then to her husband. In the blue there, she describes this man of God. She doesn't say it's an angel, but I guess if I was ever going to see an angel, it might be like this man I saw earlier today. That's how it seems to me she puts it. And then she relates the words, the important words to Manoah about this coming son. And she adds a little point that's not immediately obvious when the angel speaks. And the record we've got is the angel speaks to her first time. It must be there, but it's not recorded there. But she relates it to us now, that he's going to be a Nazarite from the womb until the day of his death. She gives that, I add a little detail, which is interesting. Because with a Nazarite vow, it was something that someone voluntarily chose to place upon themselves for a set period. You weren't born a Nazarite. You chose to be a Nazarite. A man or a woman could choose to be a Nazarite. And to do that was to live something akin to the high priest, no less. And in wearing long hair was like unto having the high priest's mitre. And there's this strict way of life which speaks of holiness, which those of the priesthood should be actually conveying to the common men and women. So when you took on the Nazarite vow, that's what you were doing. You may not be born into the Levite tribe, but you could act like unto a priest. But in this situation here, Samson has no choice in the matter. He's born into this Nazarite-like situation, and he's born in it, and he dies in it, whole life. And he's the only one in the book of Judges where we read of his birth and of his death. Start to finish. So it's very, very unusual. And those points there are very significant when you actually see out the history. He shall begin, and you see what happens to Samson at the end of his life. The angel had said to her, no razor shall come on his head. It's interesting, when she relates it to Manoah, she doesn't mention that. And so what does Manoah do? We read in verse 8 that he prays about it. He doesn't mock the woman or think she's delusional or anything like that. He takes her very, very seriously, and Manoah believes her. I think that says a lot about their relationship. She was a faithful woman. She says the most incredible things to him, and he believes her. So how strong they must have been, understanding one to the other. And then he prays. You know, we read in verse 8, O my Lord, let the man of God which thou didst send come again unto us, and teach us what shall we do unto the child that shall be born. And so quite naturally, he's suddenly thinking about this and the responsibility that's going to fall upon him. Now we're going to bring this child up. And we read in verse 9. And God hearkened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again unto the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So how interesting that is. He prays, his prayer is answered, but the angel's not sent unto him. The angel's sent unto the woman. And the picture I have is that they're both labouring in the field together, and she takes rest. He's probably doing some other duty. She takes rest, and she's on her own for a while. We're told that. And then the angel comes to her. So there's a big emphasis now throughout this chapter on the woman. All the time on the woman. So the second revelation comes to the woman. Not to Manoah, despite his prayer. His prayer is answered, but it comes to the woman. Comes to the woman. It's almost as if the angel was waiting for her to stop and waiting for him to go. And we come down to verse 13 and 14. And the angel of the Lord said unto Manoah, and obviously Manoah's coming to the presence of him now, of all that I said unto the woman, let her beware. She may not eat of anything that cometh of the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink, nor any unclean thing. All that I commanded her, let her observe. Nothing else about the education, that's it. Do that in faith, and everything else will follow on accordingly. Just do that. And the woman takes the lead. It's all about the woman. And the woman and the seed of the woman are presented to us as playing something like the role of a Nazarite. You know, these are special people before God. A chosen of God, not voluntarily, but chosen of God. Now, when you think of Samson's experience, he's contending with women, Gentile women. You know, some reckon Samson to be a womaniser and that's the end of it. I don't think so. I think the whole situation is all about the seed of the woman. And so it shouldn't surprise us when we've got this emphasis in chapter 13 of this faithful woman and her faith and the Lord revealing his purpose through her first and foremost. But when the child actually goes forth into battle, he does so by taking on the serpent's females, as it were. It comes through the woman, those women, and then on to the evil men too. So there's this emphasis throughout the life of Samson on women. But not necessarily because he's a womanizer. I don't think that at all, actually. I'll put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head and thou shalt bruise his heel. This is what's underpinning the whole of this chapter. We're seeing something of the pronouncement of the birth of Messiah. We're going to learn something in the experience of Samson as to how Messiah is going to overcome the world. So that's how it's put to us. And then we come down to verse 18. And the angel of the Lord said to him, why askest thou thus after my name, seeing it is secret? They want to know his name. That becomes an issue. And so he gives the name. I've got no idea how to pronounce that. But it's interesting. It comes up just a few times. It's then Psalm 139, verse 6, where David says, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain unto it. So they ask of him of his name, and I think he's basically saying, this is just too big. It's almost as dangerous as I don't know where to start. This is just too high and lofty. Just accept the message, act upon it, go forth in faith. And they then, in verse 19, offer a sacrifice. So we're going to offer a sacrifice unto him, but no, he puts them right on that score. unto the Lord. And so we read in verse 19, so Manoah took a kid with a meat offering and offered it upon a rock unto the Lord. And the angel did wondrously. You've got that word wondrously. It's the same root for that word as the word secret. So it's a play on the word. You've got, you know, my name, sing it, secret, and then you've got this word wondrously again. Very similar word. He did wondrously. So we're going to see something now that's beyond comprehension. We're going to have some glimpse of it. And then we're told, end of verse 19, and Manoah and his wife looked on. So they're going to see something and they're going to look upon it intently. Verse 20, for it came to pass when the flame went upward toward heaven from off the altar, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife looked on and fell on their faces to the ground. So we've got the point, brothers and sisters. We've been told once, we've been told twice, that Manoah and his wife looked on. You know, the Spirit is very keen that we should notice that. They looked on. We ought to look on as well. We ought to look at this and wonder at it and see something in it, as they were meant to see something in it. And so what did they see? They saw someone who they took to be a prophet. They certainly saw someone that was a man, to all intents and purposes. And then they see this man ascend up off the altar and go up into heaven. So they see, in effect, a sacrifice. A sacrifice was acceptable unto the Lord. And then they see a resurrection. And they see this resurrection to glory. This is pointing forward to the great victory, brothers and sisters, over sin and death. There has to be a sacrifice of He who is wonderful. And Isaiah speaks of Him in those terms. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, that same word reappears. Even the Prince of Peace, there He is. A wonderful Counselor. There it is. They see something. They see something of the death sacrifice, accepting a sacrifice acceptable before God, and a rising up. The angel did wondrously. Manoah and his wife looked on. And then you can imagine it. You know, Manoah, on with him all the way. I've got to say, I can imagine this. Verse 22, Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die because we've seen God. You know, he's probably absolutely petrified. You know, their faces onto the ground. They're on the floor, brothers and sisters. The pair are on the floor. They're excited, yes, but they're petrified all at the same time. We get that numerously. You know, on numerous occasions in Scripture, the women have that when they go to the tomb. They're running with excitement, but they've also got mixed feelings of fear. The whole thing is just totally beyond the imagination. And so he's suddenly overcome with this. What has he been dealing with? Who has he been talking to? You know, who has he had the audacity to ask for his name? And so he says this, and then she beautifully puts him right, doesn't she? You know, he says, we've seen God, and he's fearful of it. And it's interesting that we read of Jacob. Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. So Manoah unwittingly quotes the words of Jacob. I dare say, given more time and conversation, Manoah's wife, who seems so wonderfully spiritual, would have reminded him of the words of Jacob. What she does is tell him three things for the moment. The offering was received. The offering was received, remarkably. There's never been an offering received like this before. Never. Offering's been received. Why would this angel tell us all these things? If it's all about us, seeing God then to perish. What would be the point of that, Manoah? He wouldn't have spoken and made the promises, would he? And so we have this emphasis on the woman all the time. It's the woman that the revelation is given. It'll be the woman that will bear the child. And it's the woman who speaks of these wonderful things and encourages Manoah. And we don't know her name, because we are being reminded forcibly over and over again of Genesis 3, verse 15. The woman and the seed of the woman. It's a beautiful chapter. It's a fascinating chapter. And so then we come down to verse 24. And in due course, she bare a son and called his name Samson. It seems that she called him by name. Again, unusual, but emphasis on the woman. It's her son, see the woman. And she calls him Samson. And Samson means sunshine. You know, the original Sonny Jim this is, or the Sonny Boy, this is the original one. He's the sunshine. He's the little ray of sunshine. I think it's lovely. There may be some thought there in terms of the angel was sending up in that brightness, and there may be some allusion to that in calling him by that name. But in a world of darkness, hopelessness, of fear of the future, which a childless couple would have, for a couple who lived amongst a very small group of like-minded, faithful men and women, just a few, when there's so much apathy and there's much hostility of the enemy all around, what a ray of sunshine. It's a wonderful name to give this lad, Samson. Ray of sunshine. He will be a light in this dark world. And he'll be seen. And in Luke chapter 1 verse 80, we read of the Baptist. The child grew and waxed strong in spirit, and was in the deserts till the day of his showing unto Israel. And we read of our Saviour. The child grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. And those words are just a relaying really of what we read in verse 24. And the child grew and the Lord blessed him. So again, we see how special this Samson is. Like unto the Baptist, but also like unto his and our Saviour. I'm just obviously going to end now with the words of verse 25. Because we then read at the end of verse 25, end of this chapter, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan. That camp of Dan, look at the Hebrew, if they'd been consistent in 1611, they would have put Mahanath Dan, that place. That place, which is adjacent to Kirjath Jearim, which is adjacent now, assuredly, of where the camp, the Ark of God is. That's where he is, right close to the Ark. And he is going to make sure, brothers and sisters, that Philistines are never, ever going to take it again. And that's what that verse is telling us. Just put the words of Judges 18:12 alongside, just to remind you. That's where we find him. He's not at Zorah anymore. Not too far away, admittedly, but he's there amongst the Danites. But the ones that are there now, brothers and sisters, are different, aren't they? They're the ones that have faith. Those lacking faith, long time ago, went north. So he's amongst the faithful, and he's close unto the ark, and the things associated with God. And how wonderful that must have been for his parents, if indeed they're still alive. Well, they certainly would have been at the start of his life, yeah, absolutely, no question of that. They would have been delighted that he was there. And the word move, more often than not in scripture, is translated troubled. I'll just give you two examples. Genesis 41 verse 8, it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt. This is Pharaoh with his dreams, which leads on to Joseph explaining the dreams. And then in Daniel chapter 2, it's Nebuchadnezzar, same sort of thing. I have a dream, my spirit was troubled. So they were both distressed, both Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar, wanting to know the meaning of their dreams. So there's anxiety and there's restlessness. And we're seeing the same word being applied now to Samson. And the phrase "at times" is in italics, not there, so it should read, "And the Spirit of the Lord began to cause him some anxiety, some restlessness in the camp of Dan between Zorah and Eshcol." And then we're going to read in the very next verse, "And Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines," and away he goes. He's now into battle mode. And I'm very, very quickly just going to run through Judges 14, because I'm not going to be able to talk about these. Gets involved with this woman, different woman altogether to his mother, completely different to his mother. But it's all about engaging with the enemy. And all that is in that chapter 14 is about him getting into confrontation with the Philistines. Just let me scan through all that. There's so much in there. That's a night in itself. We're coming to chapter 15. And he returns to see his wife. I put it in inverted commas because I'm not altogether sure he was married to her in the fullest sense. Betrothed, certainly. But there's a whole bit of intrigue there. But it ends up with him in conflict again with the Philistines. And in doing that, he's just gone and waged war also with the fourth of the five cities. Remarkably. And so that leaves us then for next week. And I'm going to look into chapter 16. And we'll look particularly at his judgment on the fifth city. And his dealings with Delilah, which goes terribly wrong. But then it's wonderfully put right. Thank you.